سورة الفاتحة. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، بارئ الخلائق أجمعين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين، المبعوث رحمة للعالمين، شفيع المذنبين، وحبيب قلوب الصادقين، سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد
وعلى أهل بيته الأطيبين الأطهرين الهداة المهديين، ولعنة الله على أعدائهم إلى قيام يوم الدين. رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي. أما بعد، فقد قال الله عز وجل في القرآن المجيد: بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، إن أولياء الله لا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون، الذين آمنوا وكانوا يتقون. صلوا على محمد وآل محمد. Respected brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We are gathered here, as you know, on the eve of the second night of Muharram. Already the first day of the month of Al-Muharram Al-Haram has passed, and we are now commemorating the tragic events, the martyrdom, the sacrifice, the life, the mission of our beloved Imam Sayyid al-Shuhada Hussein ibn Ali. Sallu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. And his family and his companions. And this is something that is a very complex commemoration and a reminder for us of our religious values. On the one hand, the very commemoration of this grief, of this tragedy, is the greatest gift that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala can give to any believer. Those of us who have had the opportunity to visit the shrine of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam, those of us who have had the opportunity to participate in these gatherings of commemoration, in these sessions where believers come together, our mourning and our grief at their having been deprived of the right which Allah had given them within this ummah and for the guidance of humanity, that is a gift. But it is expressed not through happiness, not through congratulations, but through grief and through mourning. Now, there is still a gratitude. There is still a thanks that we owe to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for the connection. But there is a certain manner in which we are to honor and to observe that connection. And it is not through happiness, it is not through celebration, but it is through grief. And to understand how it is that we are to combine gratitude to Allah that He has given us this grief, at the same time as we are to be saddened. That is the challenge that we have every year in the month of Muharram. Believers look forward to the crescent of Muharram. But when they see the crescent in the sky, that which they were looking forward to brings tears to their eyes. The sweetest memories that many believers have of their childhood is when their families would bring them to majalis and gatherings of mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam. But those sweet memories are not ones that are associated with smiles and laughter. They are associated with grief. And the wisdom of that, the beauty of that, is that it is because we as human beings have a great crisis, a great challenge within our existence and within our societies. We have a separation from the ideal that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted us to uphold. I, as an individual, have a distance from the ideal character, knowledge, practice that Allah wants me to uphold. We as a community, as an ummah and a religious community, and all of humanity, we have a grave separation from what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted us to be. Sallu ala Muhammad wa alim uskut hadithi. Sallu ala Muhammad wa alim Muhammad. And it is because of that separation that we have to have a reminder always of the journey that we have to traverse, that distance that we have to cover in order to reach our purpose, in order to reach our potential, in order to reach our goal with success, to achieve salvation. Celebration is something that turns our attention to the past. But the grief that we have for Ahlul Bayt is not a grief about the past, and it is not a historical remembrance, but it is a grief that transcends time and history and past and present and future, and speaks to our condition as human beings and our intrinsic need to remain connected to a source of guidance from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in order to be able to achieve salvation. And this is why I have selected for a theme of our nights together during these 10 days of Muharram, the topic of the solution of our spiritual crisis through our connection to Karbala and our connection to Sayyid al-Shuhada alayhi salatu wassalam. That is the essential question that you and I need to examine and discover in order to be able to derive benefit from these gatherings and from this mourning. For some people, it is a ritual. For some people, it is a historical event. But for us, there is a ritual and a beauty in the rituals of Muharram. There is a history, and there is a great meaning and a great beauty in the history of Muharram. But if you want to find one way to connect to Imam Hussein, then it is not just through the rituals, and it is not even through the history. If you have in one hand a book of the history of Karbala. And it is the best researched and the most accurate history of what took place as far as it has been narrated in historical sources. And you have in another book poetry written by somebody who believes in Karbala and is a devotee of Imam Hussein. Now, there might not be a great deal of fact reflected in that poetry. It should not contain inaccuracies. It should not contain falsehoods. But the focus of the poetry is that connection and that love. And so it moves beyond what took place in order to try to understand the significance of what took place. The history will often have to come to a footnote and say we don't have good sources. And so between, say, this time on Ashura and this time on Ashura, I don't know exactly what took place. Or sometimes it might be the case that we have two different narrations. That, for example, Aun and Muhammad, they were either this age or they were that age. And if you have a historical view, that comes to a dead end, because you might be able to resolve it, or you might not be able to resolve it. And so you'll have to put in a footnote that I don't know exactly what order the martyrs went forward and gave their sacrifice on Ashura. I don't know exactly how old Aun or Muhammad or Muslim ibn Awsaja or other martyrs were. I don't know exactly what the sequence of some of the events was. But if you look at it from the perspective of the meaning of the poet, then he or she doesn't need to know all of those details. We have a connection to those ma'sumeen, many of the details of whose lives we will not be able to reconstruct. The daughter of the Prophet Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayha. She had one of the shortest lives of any of the ma'sumeen in the full breadth of history. You don't have a very long life. You would imagine that it should be relatively easy to say what were the details of her biography and her life. It's not a very long period where you have certain gaps. It was largely in the full view of the spread of Islam. And yet we have very few details about how she lived her daily life. Certain ahadith, certain du'as, certain memories from her children are preserved for us. But in order to be able to construct a spiritual biography, or I should say a connection to Lady Fatima salamullahi alayha, all you need to know is that the Prophet said that she is Ummu Abiha. She is like a mother to her father. All you need to know is that she was held in such high esteem by the Prophet that whenever he would leave Medina, all of his relationships, all of his family members, all of his other responsibilities were considered less significant and important to him than his connection and his relationship and his responsibility to Lady Fatima. She was the last one that the Prophet would visit when he would leave, and the first one that he would visit when he would return. That tells you all you need to know about the importance of Lady Fatima. And through that connection and that importance that the Prophet gave to her, you can develop a love for her, an attachment to her, and a sense of her significance for the understanding of Islam, then one hadith that you have from her will be more weighty than an entire book you may have from somebody else. Because you will know that that one sentence, that one dua has come from somebody who had captured the admiration and the attention of the greatest human being who ever walked on the face of the earth, before whom even the other prophets of Allah would bow their heads and say that he is our guide and our master. Sayyidul Kawnain, the Prophet of Islam, would stand in admiration and in love for Lady Fatima salamu alayhi alayha. So her one hadith, Al-Jar Thumma Dar, is something that we can take and we can contemplate on, and it is more valuable for us than if somebody else may have given us a whole philosophy or a whole book about how to pray and who to pray for. She said that when you sit down to pray, remember your neighbors, and then you think of yourself and your own family. That is an entire philosophy of life. But the importance of it comes not from the commentary, not from the length of what she said, but from who she was and what depth and profundity that message was coming from. So Karbala for us is a similar kind of a mission. Don't get caught up in just trying to reconcile the different historical narrations. That is a valuable project. And if you are interested in it, then sometime out of the first 10 days of Muharram, before or after, familiarize yourselves with the different opinions from a historical perspective. That is the opportunity for a seminar. That is the opportunity for a class. And it is a valuable exercise, because that history and those facts are an important part of what is going to allow us to be able to understand the meaning of the events. In the event that you understand all of the love that the Prophet had for Lady Fatima, but you don't know any of her sayings, and you don't know any of her du'as, then you are not going to be able to honor that connection that the Prophet had, and you are not going to be able to develop a connection yourself. And so that is important for us. But during these 10 days, if we have to prioritize, then prioritize that connection. Prioritize that poetry. Prioritize that passion. Don't prioritize the facts. And don't let the unclarity of some facts distract you from the clarity and the profundity of the spiritual message that Karbala has. Take one of the riwayat, which is not known to be false, one of the narrations that exists, and understand the meaning and understand the power of that commemoration. And later on, you can add and deepen your understanding of the historical events and their chronology and the different opinions that may exist. This is illustrated in a hadith of our 8th Imam, which pertains to this beginning of the month of Muharram. Our 8th Imam, Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salatu wa salam, he says that when the crescent of the month of Muharram was seen, then my father would not be seen in his normal state. Ahlul Bayt were known that their normal state was a smile. They were easy to laugh and difficult to make angry. That was the known practice, the known character of all of Ahlul Bayt. The Prophet was always known to be light-hearted, to always be easy to smile. Amir al-Mu'mineen, he has that statement that a believer, huznuhu fi qalbih, wa bishruhu fi wajhih. Whatever happiness you have, even at difficult moments in your life, you muster it and you bring it to your face. And whatever difficulty, whatever huzn, whatever grief you may have, you keep it in your heart. That is between you and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for private moments. But when you interact with other people, then it is with a light-hearted manner. It is with a smile. But then Imam Ridha alayhi salam says that when the moon of Muharram was sighted, at that moment the smile would no longer be seen on the face of my father, Imam Musa Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam. That was a time for his grief. And then day by day that grief would build. The first of Muharram, he would not smile. The second of Muharram, his grief would build. The third of Muharram, it would build even further. Until the 10th day of Muharram, and it was as if tragedy had just struck the household of the Imam. You would not know that decades or more than 100 years had passed since the events of Karbala. It was as if the Imam was seeing it and experiencing it just before his own eyes. In that very beautiful way, Imam Ridha has encapsulated what it means to connect during these 10 days of Muharram, not with Karbala as a historical event, but as a matter for our identity and our passion and our connection. We feel that this is part of our life, not just something that we learn about or we study, but that we experience and that we have to partake of. And so this is what we will try to do over the next 10 nights. Now, when we want to understand the significance of Karbala, there's many different levels of that connection and that significance that we can try to understand. Karbala is a beautiful lesson for us in spiritual terms. It is a beautiful lesson for us in political terms. It is a beautiful lesson for us in every avenue and every facet of Islamic discipline and learning. Every avenue of Islam, there is a connection to Karbala within it, a lesson that you can learn from Karbala. But I want to focus during our limited time together on what lessons we can learn for our spiritual health and our spiritual well-being. And I termed that a spiritual crisis. And so the first question that I would like us to think about is, do we have a spiritual crisis? There's many times when we have people who think there is a crisis and there is no crisis. Sometimes if you are taking care of young children, you might be working in the next room, taking care of something important, and all of a sudden you hear a loud cry from your child. You come thinking that something terrible has taken place. You ask, what's the problem? What is the crisis? And they will say that, while I was playing with my friend, I was playing with my brother or my sister, they took my toy. They called me a name. Now here you were looking for your phone, thinking to call 911, and you find out that the crisis is something which you would not even have thought twice about. But you can't tell that child that it is nothing. You have to slowly bring them up to speed that this is not a crisis worth shedding tears about and saying that I'm never going to talk to you again and I'm never going to play with you again and I'm never going to have anything to do with you again. There are times when we don't have a crisis and we think that we have a crisis. And part of that difference that we have as adults, it comes from our different experiences. It comes from the different environments that we inhabit. Right now, there are some people in this country who will say that We have a crisis about the climate and the environment, and it should keep us awake at night. And there are other people who say that don't worry about it. There is no such thing as a human influence on the climate. It's all fake news. There are some people who are very concerned about the crisis of healthcare and how many people lack and how many people have inadequate healthcare. And there are other people who say that that's not a crisis, it's not a problem. It's made up. We have the very best healthcare system in the world, and anybody can get treatment if they need it in an emergency room. Emergency rooms can't turn you away because you lack insurance. It's a made-up crisis. Now, it might be difficult to imagine somebody saying that, but in the recent past and even today, you will find that there are people who say that there is no healthcare crisis in this country. There is no crisis about law enforcement and criminal justice. That is just something that is a matter of propaganda. But for other people, they know and they appreciate that this is something very real and very important. And so the first challenge that we have to overcome is to understand that should we think of our spiritual state as a crisis, or should we think of it as a potential problem, maybe somewhere over the horizon? I should be careful about it, but I shouldn't be that worried about it. It shouldn't keep me awake. I would say, is it like the climate? But the climate can be all of those different degrees of importance, depending on who you are and what information you have access to and what information you believe. And then if you scratch a little bit further beneath the surface, you find that within our communities, we have different responses about these symptoms that we see. You go to a wedding. Now we are past the wedding season in the Muslim community. Summer has passed and the month of Dhul-Hijjah has passed. And so now it is safe to look back at how our weddings are conducted. And inshallah, that will not offend anybody who has a wedding coming in the next few days, because that season has passed. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. But if you think about that, and you see that sometimes many of our most basic Islamic values are compromised in those ceremonies. They are not just an opportunity to invite community and family and share in the happiness of the beginning of a union and the coming together of two families. And I'm not just talking about questions of hijab. I'm not just talking about questions of entertainment. Those are important questions. But I'm also referring to the extravagance and the competition that we have to impress and to outdo and to focus on each individual feeling like that day was unique and special by being better than or more impressive than the function or the event that might have been put out by another family or another person in the community. So we have many different areas in which those types of gatherings, they don't reinforce Islamic values, they side-skirt Islamic values, or they damage our commitment and our connection to our Islamic values. Is that a crisis? Or is it just a minor symptom? Should we respond to that by saying that, well, it's just one day in the year, let them enjoy it, and then there will be another opportunity to give religious admonition and advice and guidance? Don't always try to inject a certain religious restriction into a person's life. You have different responses. When it comes to our daily life, when it comes to our marital life, when it comes to the different symptoms we find within our communities. And for many of us, we don't always know whether we should consider something to be a serious problem or less serious of a problem. And so we often have burnout, where we say that I don't even know what to give importance to. You have people who are burned out because of the news. You have people who are burned out because everything is a crisis. Your diet is a crisis. The way you sleep is a crisis. And now they have articles and they have videos with the headline, "You're doing it wrong." Many of us learn that we don't even know how to boil an egg and how to peel a banana and how to do the most simple tasks in our life because the information is coming to us that there is a crisis in just the way that we prepare our lunch, let alone the more serious decisions within our life. And so the first question that we have to be able to understand is, where can we determine what is a crisis and what is not? Is it going to be on the basis of our mind? Is it going to be on the basis of our feelings and our heart? I might feel that something is a big deal, but my mind tells me it is not a big deal. Sometimes we refer to experts, and what they tell us differs from what we feel. If you go to a medical professional, you say that I'm feeling nausea, and I have a cold sweat, and I have this constriction in my chest radiating out to my hands, they might tell you to go to the hospital. These are symptoms that you need to be examined. They might be dangerous. And then you tell that person that, well, I felt a lot worse when I had the flu a few weeks ago, and you didn't tell me that it was that essential for me to get immediate treatment. It's not always what we feel. It's not always what we know. If you are an expert, then you might see things with one view, and if you are not an expert, then you might see things with a very different view. You might think that something is a big deal and say that I need an immediate prescription, and the expert says that no, you don't have to worry about it. This is not a big deal. And then there might be something that you would be willing to ignore. It's just indigestion. It's just a little bit of shortness of breath. I exerted myself. And the expert will say that no, this is something that you need to be checked for. And so our solution to all of those confusions that we have is to make sure that we have access to expertise in understanding what is a crisis, what might seem to be a big deal, but we should ignore it. What might not seem to be a big deal, but we should give it a great deal of importance. And then how should we respond? The major spiritual challenges of history, they are the same way. The people of Ad are described in the Quran. They came to their prophet Hud. They said that, all right, we're tired of all of this preaching and all of this warning that there is going to be a crisis, there is going to be a punishment. Bring us this punishment if you're telling the truth. And Prophet Hud says that I am just a warner. I am not going to punish you. God is going to punish you. He told me to give you the message. And then the punishment comes. And they say, "Hada aribun mumtiruna." Clouds bringing rain. We're going to have a good harvest this year. And that was the punishment that was going to destroy them and make them a lesson for history. They thought it was going to be something good, but it was something that had their destruction within it. Or the son of Prophet Nuh. The Quran says that the flood had already begun. This is not just the first drops coming out of the oven. This is not just the first drops of rain, but the Safina of Prophet Nuh, the ship, was carried over waves that were like mountains. Tempestuous waves, a tsunami. And Prophet Nuh saw his son in the distance, and he said, "Join us on the ship." And he said, "Sa'awi ila jabalin ya'simuni min al-ma." I'll go to a mountain, and I can see it is a crisis. I can see it is a storm, it is a flood. But the ship might sink, I will go to a mountain. That is where I will have the maximum safety. And he was destroyed. And so what is that expertise? What is that ship that can save us? And that is the importance of a connection to Ahlul Bayt. Because our minds are not always enough. They are in need of training and development. Our feelings are not always enough. They are in need of training and in need of development. If you want to train your mind, to train your heart, to train your feelings, to be able to understand what it is that you should give importance to, what it is that you should be worried about, what it is that you should be comfortable with, and what you should be uncomfortable with, then you need to have that connection to Ahlul Bayt. That is why they are known as Safinatun Naja. Man rakibaha naja. Waman takhallafa anha ghariqa wa hawa. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. That is why when the Quran brings us to that commitment to worship only Allah, to seek help only from Allah, then to put us on that path, he says that pray to be guided to the path of الَّذِينَ أَنْعَمْتَ عَلَيْهِمْ, and to be separated from those who are astray and those who have become worthy of Allah's wrath. That connection to certain people and that disconnection from evil people and misguided people, that is what is going to be the most important factor that will train your heart to be able to feel what it should feel when it should feel it. And that will train your mind to see and to understand what it should understand when it should understand it. In other words, we are embarking on a journey with Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalatu wassalam. We are embarking on that path. And this path of Karbala, it was a journey in spirit, and it was a journey also through the lands of Islam, from Medina to Karbala. Not a terribly long journey, but a journey that began in grief and a journey that ended in grief. And today is the beginning of our joining Imam Hussein and his companions on that journey. The beginning point is in Medina, the city of the Prophet. And what memories for Ahlul Bayt, and in particular for Imam Hussein, are associated with Medina? This was the city in which he was born and the city in which he was raised. A city filled with the memories of his mother whom he lost at a young age. A city filled with the memories of his grandfather, the Prophet of Allah. Whenever the eyes of the Prophet would fall upon Imam Hussein, then whatever the Prophet might be doing, he would turn towards Imam Hussein. And you wouldn't know whether the grandfather's love for his grandson was greater, or the grandson's love for his grandfather was greater. If the Prophet saw Imam Hussein, he would come running. And if Imam Hussein saw the Prophet, he would run to the Prophet, and they would embrace. That would be the case. Whatever the Prophet might be doing, whomever he might be speaking to, sometimes he would give his khutbah in the masjid and he would have Imam Hussein in his arms. And when he would pause for a breath, he would kiss Imam Hussein to show his love. The Prophet, when he was tired after a long day of work, he would come at the end of the day and he would play as a child with Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein. And sometimes Amir al-Mu'mineen and Lady Fatima would see something very unusual from the Prophet. When he would be playing with Imam Hussein, he would begin to embrace the Imam and he would sometimes kiss the Imam. Sometimes he would kiss the forehead of the Imam. Sometimes he would kiss the neck of the Imam. Sometimes he would kiss the hands of the Imam. And as he would do so, he would shed tears. And Lady Fatima asked her father that, "Oh my father, you have such love for your grandson that I have never seen any parent, any grandparent express such love. Why is it that when you embrace him, you shed tears?" And the Prophet said that, "Lady Fatima, I see what you do not yet see. And I see that which if I were to describe to you, then you might not be able to bear it. Just suffice it to know that when I see before me where the stones will hit the body of the Imam, and I see the wounds that will cover his body, where there will be spears and where there will be arrows and where there will be different injuries, then I cannot help but kiss those blessed parts of the body of the Imam." This was how the Prophet raised Imam Hussein, with that love and with those tears, until the month of Rajab in the 60th year of Hijrah came, and the Imam is to begin his journey. He went and he threw himself upon the grave of his grandfather, the Prophet. But now there was no embrace, because the Prophet was in the grave, and the Imam threw himself and said, "Ya Rasulullah, this is your city and a place of safety, a sanctuary for all Muslims." Human beings, even animals, they come to this city for peace, for security, and your grandson is not safe. Your family and your progeny is not safe in this city. Oh, my grandfather Rasulullah, forgive me, for I must depart your company, where I will no longer be able to come to your grave every day and do ziyarah as is my heart's desire. Forgive me, for I must bid farewell." And it is said that at that moment, Imam Hussein went and he saw in a vision-like state that the Prophet had come to him and said that, "Hussein, you are not bidding farewell to me. For 50 years I have been separated from you. For 50 years at the gates of paradise, your mother is waiting for you. Come, O Hussein, inna mushtaquna ilayk. We are waiting for you to come. We are eager to be reunited with you. Your grandfather, your mother, your father, your brother Hassan al-Mujtaba, we are all waiting for you." The Imam left Medina, passing through various stages. He arrived at Karbala. And you know that when the Imam arrived at Karbala, his horse refused to go beyond that point. According to some narrations, the Imam asked the people, "What is this land?" They said that it has many names: Ghadiriyya, Nainawa, Shattul Furat, until the Imam said, "Is there any other name by which this land is known?" And somebody said, "They call this land Karbala." And the Imam said, "A'udhu billahi min al-karb wal-bala. This is the land that my grandfather promised to me." And the Imam came down from his horse and he put the sands of Karbala in his hands and he kissed those sands as his father had done on the way back from Siffin. And the Imam repeated the same words that Imam Ali had said more than 20 years earlier when he was coming back from the Battle of Siffin. "This is where the blood will be shed. This is where the captives will be bound and taken to various dungeons. This is where the courageous men of Bani Hashim will be martyred." And Lady Zainab came forward. She said to the Imam that, "I do not have any demands, but is it possible for us to move quickly past this area? Because ever since we have entered this land, my heart is uneasy." And the Imam said that, "Oh, my sister Zainab, this is where our grandfather told us that we are going to have our final encampment." But the Imam was sensitive to the grief of Zainab. He would have said, "Oh, Abbas, come. Oh, Ali Akbar, come. Oh, no, Muhammad, come. Surround my sister Zainab so she doesn't feel like she is alone." As Lady Zainab disembarked from her horse, then she would have had Abbas on one side, Ali Akbar on the other side. They would have brought her to where her tent was going to be set up. They would have put her with dignity and with honors in that place where she was going to spend the coming nights. I can only imagine how Lady Zainab must have looked towards their bodies on the 11th of Muharram and said, "Oh, Ali Akbar, oh, Abbas, oh, Auna Muhammad, you who came with such honors to let me find my camp. Now I am embarking on my horse once again. Where are you to show me which way I should face and how I am to make that journey to Kufa?" Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Wa sayalamu alladhina zalamu ayyamun talabiyan qalib.